Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Gary Bain. And I'm joined once more by Peter Hart. Good morning, Pete.
Hello, Gary. It's lovely. And what? Today we're starting a new series. In fact, it's the next big thing we're doing. It's the series that will guide us through this season. And what's this season called? It's called Air War Over the Somme. Or Somme Success, if you remember that book I wrote. But never mind. And the first episode is Setting the Scene. Professionalism personified.
Yeah, excuse me. Now, in the beginning, there was the ground war.
There was.
Now, the entrenched armies face each other across no man's land, all along the Western Front. An inviolable line, inviolable, Pete.
Inviolable.
That marked the end of the brief period of open warfare in 1914.
Yeah, so as the armies crashed into each other, biffy boff, biff boff, the soldiers sort of scratched themselves impromptu cover and because it's certain death to stay above ground.
I've scratched myself impromptu cover.
Yes, you have.
Now, they sought sanctuary from the streams of machine gun bullets and crashing detonations of artillery shells that typified modern warfare. Gradually, these tentative scrapings were deepened.
A lot of purple prose in this opening bit.
And extended until an unbroken front was created from which they could pour fire into any attack made upon them. So the line froze into immobility.
Yep, then there'd be a second or third line dug, and then the whole system's interconnected with communication trenches. That lets troops get, you know, replacement troops come into the line, etc., etc.
And they never have to raise their heads above the trench parapet, so relative safety.
Now, is this, do people think, well, that's it for a while, or are people, what do people think?
I think what you're trying to say is both sides were relatively confident that the trenches were temporary resting places while they girded their metaphorical loins for the next great attack.
Are you girding your metaphorical loins as we speak?
That would surely rupture. So you've got loins and rupture in the same sentence.
Yeah, that's good.
The enemy's line. Allowing a resumption of old-style open warfare, culminating in an enjoyably satisfying advance to victory in Berlin or Paris, depending on perspective. And tea and biscuits.
Tea and biscuits, absolutely. However, it's an intractable problem. They very soon discover in 1915, and a lot of pre-war experience doesn't seem to have been much value to them, does it?
No, certainly not. And there was another new factor.
What's that?
Aircraft.
Ooh.
Though before the war, the military value of the aeroplane had been clearly recognised, the first powered flight by the Wright brothers had only taken place some 11 years earlier, which we think is, well, I know, 1903.
I've never known which year. I always think it's 1904. But
now, aircraft were developing rapidly, but their limitations in 1914-15 were considerable.
Yeah, well, dangerously low speeds, because the margin between safe flying and stalling was very narrow. And a lot of the aircraft only flew at about 60 to 80 miles an hour. That's barely enough to get them in the air and keep them in the air, more to the point, I suppose. There's other problems, though, about flying. What are they?
Well, it wasn't fully understood, and consequently aerial manoeuvres were often carried out on the basis of guesswork. They simply repeated actions that had not actually resulted in disaster last time they were tried.
Oh, that's a yes. Mm. How do they know? Because if a disaster
when they were still alive.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Now, the science of aeronautics was literally in its infancy. Underpowered as they were, the amount of weight that each aircraft could lift was sufficient. Why have you got me doing the bit about weight?
No reason, Gary.
Right. The amount of weight that each aircraft could lift was severely limited, and this hindered any attempt to develop any real military strike role by deploying bombs or machine guns. So it just couldn't carry any weight at all.
Yeah, so you would not have been an appropriate pilot for those times.
Thanks, mate.
Cheers, mate. Nor would I, by the way. So what is the immediate thing that aircraft offer to the generals or the military? And the obvious one is aerial reconnaissance. The poor old embattled general, he can through his acolytes. Acolytes.
Where's this going?
His pilots, his observers can rise above the battle and gain access to the minutiae of the opponent's dispositions and movements. In other words, you have to put it in English as opposed to whatever language I was just speaking. They could fly over where the enemy are and see what's happening.
I wish you'd said that in the first place.
Yeah, would have been easier.
Now, Reams, I've always wanted to go to Reams. Reams of vital intelligence could be harvested at the risk of just a few daring aviators flying deep into enemy territory, rather than the much more limited results offered by the conventional reconnaissance enforced by cavalry.
Yeah, they can't always go... Well, especially with trenches, that's just not possible, is it?
Now, although the great powers... I'll do this bit because you'll blow on your nose. Although the great powers invested to some degree in aircraft before the war, rigid airships were seen by many as a far more promising method of pursuing aerial warfare. Why was that?
Well, they've got a greater range of operations, but they also have they can lift more. So they could lift... they could even have you on board, but they could also... as well as you, they could have loads of bombs and which they could use to destroy their enemies. Kill them all.
The Royal Flying Corps, that's the RFC.
Fine body of men.
Had gone to war under the command of Sir David Henderson with just four squadrons that in all totaled some 63 serviceable aircraft.
Now, the RFC it proved its worth in this reconnaissance role, it helped expose the workings of the German Schlieffen plan to the rather sceptical Sir John French. And also their reconnaissance reports, along with the French reconnaissance aircraft reports, formed a base for Joffre's brilliant manoeuvring, reorganisation and counterattack, which, in my view, won the war, the Battle of the Marne, because I think that was the point that the Germans were in a lot of trouble. So that's the reconnaissance role. But then there were other advances, and these advances were made incredibly early in the war. What were they? Because for all this shite you hear talked about how slow-moving the military are, when do they start to make big advances?
Well, I think you're referring to aerial photo reconnaissance, and that began on the 15th of September.
Which year?
1914.
Well, isn't that only a month after the war started?
30 days after September. Yeah. Now, it began with a mission undertaken by one Lieutenant George Frederick Prettyman above the emerging German trenches in the Aisne Hills, which had blocked the Allied advance.
Now, aerial photography, it's obvious, really, but it greatly expands the reconnaissance capabilities of an aircraft. Instead of a notebook, which people could jot things down, the plates, because they're glass plates, you could take a photograph, then examine them when you get back home. And what there's a whole new science that develops of photographic interpretation.
Now, that was born as the slightest traces of German activity could be exposed to the camera in the sky. So, you could try and hide certain things. You could camouflage the guns, for example. But tracks.
Yeah, you know, all sorts of things.
At the same time...
Ah, is this something else then?
The first wirelesses were carried into the sky. I bet they were heavy. I bet they were big.
They could only have one-way communication. That's right. Okay.
Where they provided aerial observation that allowed the British artillery to range onto targets invisible to their ground level forward observation posts.
So just a month after the RFCs landed in France, the two most important roles throughout the war had already been defined, and the process of refining them had begun.
In addition,
This is less important.
Small bombs had been carried into the air to attack targets of opportunity, such as columns of troops. Meanwhile, the Royal Naval Air Service, that's the RNAS, fine body of men, which was the Royal Navy equivalent of the RFC, had begun to experiment in strategic bombing raids on Zeppelin sheds, naval bases, and even German towns.
Small scale, I would say ineffectual, certainly in the context of later events and later wars, but it's the first steps, and this would lead to what happened, the devastation of whole cities. But it's very small, tiny little tippy-tappy steps.
Now, however, it was equally apparent that their German opposite numbers were performing the same function. The curtain had been lifted for both sides.
So German aircraft are doing the same sort of things, yeah.
It was obvious that a great advantage would be gained by blinding the aerial eyes of the opposing forces. Thus, although they were hamstrung by the weaknesses of their aircraft, right from the start, aviators harboured murderous designs against each other.
Oh, I've got murderous designs.
Now, observers carried rifles or shotguns, and they exchanged fire with their counterparts wherever possible.
There's a problem with that, because it's not easy. I mean, it's not easy to hit things anyway, especially if you're like me. But hitting a fast-moving target with a single-shot weapon from a moving vehicle or aircraft, there's very few casualties in the first opening months of the war. Why didn't they take a Lewis gun or something like that up?
Well, that also floundered because even that extra weight crippled the performance of the aircraft. Go back to what you were saying about their speed, 60 miles an hour. Yeah. Seemingly, you could have speed and altitude or a machine gun, but not both. It was a similar thing with the battlecruisers when we were doing the Jutland episode, wasn't it?
It is. A battlecruiser couldn't have everything. They could have armour or speed or gun. They could have two of them.
And they couldn't fly.
And they couldn't fly. Not off. I bet HMS Warspite could.
Although few aviators were killed directly by enemy action, the multifarious dangers of flying caused a constant hemorrhaging.
Have you swallowed a dictionary?
Of men and machines in accidents.
Oh, accidents is a word I understood. Yeah. So at the front, just this, it's all you could call it natural erosion. The RFC is withering away, but their importance has been really well recognised. And what indication of the importance can we get? Well, who spotted how important it is?
Well, a rapid expansion was ordered by the Minister of War, one Field Marshal Lord Kitchener, to achieve a target of some 100 squadrons,
so
or
he did
100
this,
even.
He did that right early in the war then?
He did, but unfortunately it was far easier envisaged than actually carried out. Britain didn't have an aeronautics manufacturing industry that could suddenly turn on the tap to build the hundreds of aircraft that would be required.
Isn't there something else they'd need?
Yeah. Pilots, observers and ground mechanics were also in scarce supply, and their training would actually take a long time.
Yeah. Now, one thing they could do, simplify things, and this is part of a later tragedy in the war, it was decided early on to concentrate on producing just one main aircraft as the workhorse for all these squadrons. They're called corps squadrons. They provide the reconnaissance and artillery observation functions. Because of the time it takes to build aircraft and train pilots, this decision was taken in 1914, but it would really impact on what happened to the pilots in 15 and 16 and even early 17. And what was the name of the aircraft? And give me the full name, please, Gary.
The choice settled on was the BE-2C, variant C. That's the Blériot Experimental.
Well done. Great name for an aeroplane.
There are some fantastic names, which I'm sure we'll come on to.
Now, it's an all-purpose tractor aeroplane. What does that mean? Come on, Gary, what's a tractor aircraft?
The engine was at the front of the aircraft, so it pulled it.
And they're designing a sequence. It started with BE-1, you'll be surprised to know. And they were built by the Royal Aircraft Factory, which is not the RAF we know and love. It's a different one, based at Farnborough. It's got great advantages as a photographic reconnaissance and artillery observation machine. It really has. It's fabulous for that role. in many ways. It's inherently stable, and when once it's up in the air, it could almost fly itself, which is important when you have to take photographs and the rest of it. What was its flying speed? Although it depends what height you are, but you know.
Yeah, so 72 mile per hour at 6,500 feet and 69 mile per hour is its service ceiling of 10,000 feet.
Could it whiz up there like a flash?
Indeed it could. It took a lamentable 45 minutes to
That's
reach
a
that
very
height.
Slow flash.
Yes. The B-2C was reaching the front in ever-increasing quantities by mid-1915. And here it proved a safe flying machine that would provide yeoman service in its designed role.
No, it's got one serious flaw, and this becomes apparent later in the war. It was not and could never be an effective aircraft in aerial combat. It's just not designed for it. And here is Lieutenant Charles Chabot, or Chabot, I don't know. Aye, Chabot, 4th Squadron RFC. What does he say, Gaz?
The B-2C was the first aircraft that was to be really inherently stable. The dihedral on the wings. Now,
what's
dihedral.
That?
Now, a dihedral wing, it has an upward angle of the wing from a horizontal axis, which that's why the aircraft is so stable.
Do you understand that?
No.
You looked it up, didn't
I think
you?
On a modern plane, it's the bit at the end of the wings that goes up.
All right. Now, carry on with what Mr. Chabot says.
The dihedral on the wings gave it lateral stability. The dihedral at which the tail plane was set in relation to the main planes gave it fore and aft stability.
Avast behind.
The lateral stability was very strong indeed. It would correct anything by itself. A very stable aircraft. From the flying point of view, this had the very great disadvantage that as the machine wanted to stay on a level keel right way up, it was very difficult to make it do anything else.
Now, let's go on to the development. This is all leading up to this one, but as I said, this is setting the scene. First British attempt to break out the straitjacket of trench warfare, the first big one, was done by 1st Army under General Sir Douglas Haig. It's the Battle of Neuve Chapelle, launched on 10th of March 1915. Now, Haig is a real trendsetter, pace setter here, because he builds the RFC into his overall plan. And he uses the aerial observation to create maps and identify German batteries and strong points. And the photographic map they produce is fabulous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's of the whole German defensive trench system. Some of the technical problems of aerial artillery observation were gradually being overcome following the introduction of accurate mapping and the clock code, which allowed the observer to relay the fall of each round to the Royal Artillery gunners.
Yeah, we're not going to explain that because we've done it too many times before.
And we don't understand it.
I do understand it. You know I do.
The RFC were also responsible for bombing raids on German troops in their bases behind the lines and for interdiction, that's preventative or prohibitive, attacks to disturb the movement of troops and munitions by destroying key transport installations.
Now, Neuve Chapelle, the Battle of Neuve Chapelle, fantastic bombardment, a shell every 6 yards, Gary, I think we've discovered, of the frontline trenches. There weren't many trenches behind.
Yeah, thanks, but I was going to use that later.
I know you were. That's why I thought I'd step in and ruin your little bit later. It is an interesting battle. The British break in, but they can't break through. It all falls apart. But the battles of Albers Ridge and Festival, how are they?
They were doomed to failure by an insufficient concentration of artillery and an increasing shell shortage, which meant that not even the German front line could be effectively breached.
So they get shot a bit.
As the trench systems grew ever more complex, there was a pressing need to know what was happening on the other side of the barbed wire. The location of German machine gun posts, saps, mortar pits, command posts, signals stations and artillery gun positions had a crucial significance should the British intend to make an attack.
Yeah, but there's also, they hit deeper, actually you could tell things, the varying intensity of road and rail traffic, coupled with where you can monitor where camps and ammunition dumps are established, they could all signal what, Gary? What could they signal?
An impending German offensive, and in the reverse, an Allied offensive for the Germans.
Yeah, so you've got to prevent the Germans from getting that intention.
Intelligence.
Yeah,
you said intention.
That's because I've got the intention of being lovely.
Now, anti-aircraft guns were making their appearance on both sides, and although they rarely scored a direct hit, as they increased in number, they became gradually more inconvenient and threatening, especially to low-flying aircraft committed to flying in straight lines for their reconnaissance and observation.
So is that all they could do, or is there anything else that could threaten the enemy's aircraft?
Well, it was inevitable that the first real fighter aircraft armed with machine guns should appear, as the rapid improvements in aircraft performance allowed more weight to be carried aloft.
Now, the first, there's several new ones, but the one that we know best is the Bristol Scout. In fact, there's been one built by one of our friends, rebuilt, or rather, and it's the first generation of single-seat Scout aircraft. What was it designed to do?
Rapidly fly ahead of the army to scout and report what they had found. These scouts in time bequeathed their name as a generic type to the early fighter aircraft.
Yeah, it's gone. It's now fighter, but it was in the First World War mostly scout. Now, the first purpose-built British aircraft designed to destroy German aircraft was the Vickers FB-5 biplane pusher. Pusher, Gary?
Engine tucked behind the pilot and observer.
All right.
So at the back.
So it was armed with a pillar-mounted Lewis gun in the observer's front nacelle, powered by a 100-horsepower Gnome Mono Supe engine. It could get up to 70 miles an hour at 5,000 feet. Effective ceiling of 7,000 feet.
Yes, get that right. The Vickers fighter...
Just picture a Vickers fighter at 70,000 feet.
The Vickers fighter enjoyed considerable success, but the summer of 1915 was marked by the gestation of the next generation of Scout aircraft that would change the whole complexion of the war in the air. The Fokker Eindecker E1...
What did you say it was called, Gary?
The Fokker Eindecker E1 reached the front and scored their first victories over their flabbergasted opponents in July and August 1915.
Why were they flabbergasted?
Well, yeah, I mean, what was so special about it, I suppose, was that it had the synchronised or interrupter mechanism. So that
you don't know which, do you?
I think it's the synchronised, actually.
Don't know.
That it could fire through the propeller.
Through the propeller, Gary?
Well, not through it. I mean, the propeller would interrupt to allow it to fire through the gaps, as opposed to earlier designs which had, for example, metal put onto the wooden propeller and would deflect the rounds always everywhere and even back at you.
Now, this marks that summer of 15, you started to get the very first beginnings of what would be rather romantically, not romantically, over-exaggeratedly called the Fokker Scourge. And it's the end of the period of relative security for the Royal Flying Corps over the Western Front. Not many casualties at first, because they don't know how to use them, but there's two German pilots, who really become a bit of a threat, who seem to learn what to do and how to do it. Who are these masked men?
Lieutenants Max Immelmann and Oswald Bolker.
We've heard of these before.
And in those two, the Germans had two young men with both the courage and brains to exploit the superiority that the Fokker gave them over any British aircraft then available on the Western Front.
So they were a deadly pair of Fokkers.
God, do you know what? In my head, I'm thinking, we've done well to resist it. Gradually, they learnt to use the relatively high altitude ceiling of the Fokker to lurk far above the lines until they sighted their prey, upon which they would dive down out of the dazzling sun to attack their prospective victim from behind to capitalise on their advantage in being able to fire straight ahead. They also began to hunt together as a pair, and soon informal gatherings of three or four Fokkers would work together to maximise their deadly effect, whilst reducing the collective risk as far as possible. Have you seen what you've done?
Yes. Now, the advent of the Fokker, what does that expose? What does it show up?
For the B-2C, it was its inherent stability now became a severe handicap, as it could not be swiftly and effectively manoeuvred to take rapid evasive action. It comes back to that earlier quote about, you know, it just wants to stay straight and true.
Now, the other thing, the B2C is a tractor aircraft, but the British don't have the synchronisation gear, so they can't fire forward. They've only got the observer behind. But there's something else worse than that, because is the pilot in front?
No, the observer sat in the front cockpit, where both his view and field of fire were obstructed by the wings and a linking forest of struts and wires that he would be well advised not to shoot away.
Why not? Its wing will fall off.
Without parachutes, the crews were often left imprisoned in a flaming coffin. Although the casualties were very small in comparison with those suffered in the trenches below them, it became apparent that something would have to be done if the RFC was to continue to carry out its duties effectively.
Back in Britain, you see, the obsolescent BA2Cs, they're continuing to roll off the production lines. And the contracts have been signed. There's no flexibility in the system. And they can't change course
rapidly. Even if they did, it would take time.
Yeah, absolutely. And while we think, we're going to take a little bit of time out now.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Now, the Royal Flying Corps, RFC, were heavily engaged at this time. And they're getting ready for what? What are they getting ready for, Gary?
The Battle of Loos, which was launched on the 25th of September 1915.
Yeah, now there's a bit of a patchy first day. Patchy. It's not patchy if you're killed. The offensive grinds to a halt, fails in a welter of blood and guts. Again, they can break in, they can't break through. The fighting drags on into October, by which time, who's making themselves their presence felt increasingly?
Well, the Fokkers.
Yeah.
In December 1915, the British Commander-in-Chief, Field Marshal Sir John French, is replaced by General Sir Douglas Haig. Early on in the war, Haig had recognised the prime importance of artillery and therefore the crucial importance of the RFC in directing it to its best effect.
Now, there's another change that had happened. And what Major General Sir David Henderson, that's the old boss of the RFC in France, had gone home. He'd gone to take a key post, Director General of Military Aeronautics. And who replaces him? One of our favourites, our all-time favourites.
Hugh Trenchard, Lieutenant Colonel at that time, Hugh Trenchard, was promoted to Brigadier and given the command of the RFC on the Western Front in August 1915. Now, he was a brash, booming man.
Booming.
And as a result, he was nicknamed Boom.
Boom!
Who was intolerant of failure. He nevertheless had a certain panache that let him get away with statements that might seem inflammatory from a lesser man. And this is Brigadier General Hugh Trenchard of the Headquarters Royal Flying Corps. I'm not asking you to do anything I wouldn't do myself. just because I'm condemned to ride about in a big Rolls-Royce and sit out the fighting in a chair. You mustn't think I don't understand. Now, such phrases became almost a catchphrase in the RFC. Trenchard was greatly assisted in his task by the tact and outstanding competence of his ADC, Captain Maurice Baring. It sort of acted as a balance to boom.
That's right. And this is a quote from Captain Archibald James. We'll talk about my relationship indirectly with Archibald James a bit later when it comes to a more pompous quote. But he was a foreign chap, and he said this. Trenchard's personality and abilities took him to the top early on. He was that peculiar thing, a totally inarticulate genius. He had no power of expression whatsoever, either verbally or on paper. He always had to have by him somebody to collect and correct his English, his thought, and so on. During the whole war, this was performed by Maurice Baring, one of the most charming men that ever lived. Brilliant writer, charming person, and he knew all the squadrons which Boom visited very frequently. It became a catchword. Take that damn Baring! He always followed up everything. You always follow through everything, don't you? Trivial or of major importance, that came under his notice. Excellent.
Yes.
All right. Trenchard had... What? Hey?
Trenchard had developed an unswerving belief that the RFC was part of and entirely subordinate to the requirements of the army. Hence, they must do whatever was required and bear the inevitable losses to service those needs.
As a result, over 50 RFC pilots and observers were shot down between November 1915 and January 1916. So you've got this Fokker scourge raging. But following Trenchard's line, what does the RFC have to do?
It's got to continue to do its duty, and it was duty,
at
all costs. Methods could be modified, but not the overall aggressive aerial approach. And this is once more Brigadier General Hugh Trenchard of the Headquarters RFC. Until the Royal Flying Corps are in possession of a machine as good or better than the German Fokker, it seems that a change in the tactics employed becomes necessary. It is hoped very shortly to obtain a machine which will be able to successfully engage the Fokkers at present in use by the Germans. In the meantime, it must be laid down as a hard and fast rule that a machine proceeding on reconnaissance must be escorted by at least three other fighting machines. These machines must fly in close formation, and a reconnaissance should not be continued if any of the machines become detached. This should apply to both short and distant reconnaissances. Aeroplanes proceeding on photographic duty any considerable distance east of the line should be similarly escorted. From recent experience, it seems that the Germans are now employing their aeroplanes in groups of three or four, and these numbers are frequently encountered by our aeroplanes. Flying in close formation must be practised by all pilots.
So this is a hard and fast rule of dealing with the Fokkers.
It is, yes. Trenchard didn't intend to give up the dangerous reconnaissances. He was merely modifying his tactics to reflect the change in circumstances.
Well, that was more than acceptable to Sir Douglas Haig, because he's getting what he needs. And that's all that matters, really. It's brutal in a sense, but it's just what has to happen, isn't it? What else is Trenchard doing?
Yeah, this is interesting. He developed a policy of replacing all casualties on the day of their demise.
You see, they've got a pool of pilots and observers back at the base at St. Omer. And this ensures that his insistence on a full breakfast table with no empty chairs wasn't just empty words. It seems callous, but there isn't. It's in fact designed to help improve squadron morale. And let's hear from Hugh Trenchard as to why that is.
I always looked on the RFC as a family. I tried to put myself in the others' places and to consider the feelings of those who flew as if they had been my own. If, as an ordinary pilot, you see no vacant places around you, the tendency is to brood less on the fate of friends who have gone forever. Instead, your mind is taken up with buying drinks for the newcomers and making them feel at home. It was a matter of pride and human understanding.
You are human.
Yeah. Now, meanwhile, his pilots learnt to make the best of a bad job. They didn't meekly surrender their lives, but strove to overcome the manifest design faults of their aircraft. One observer, flying in BE-2Cs, codified the results of his hard-won experience and the advice other survivors had given to him. And this is Lieutenant Bernard Rice of the 2nd Squadron Royal Flying Corps.
Yeah, and he says this, "Notes on combat in air. Attack on the same level if possible. In BE-2C, use side mounting. Don't open fire over 500 yards. You don't carry enough cartridges to waste. Fire in bursts of not over 10. Switch your guns quickly to back mounting as he passes and fire remainder of drum. 1. If Hun dives, replace gun on side bracket. 2. Attack as before. 3. Put gun on front mounting and dive for position under tail. Never follow up a machine directly behind. He will rake you through and through. Never let a machine get under your tail. Never let a machine swoop down on you unawares from behind. At first sound of a shot from behind, turn to right and left with nose down before looking round even. It is with his first burst of fire that the Fokker scout gets his machine down. If an EA, that's enemy aircraft, scout presses his attack home and persists in following, go into a slow spiral, losing as little height as possible." And I think that's, you know, they're thinking about what to do.
And if you listen to that, you can sort of almost imagine, you know, trying to throw the aircraft around in the air.
Which doesn't want to be thrown about.
Exactly.
You can imagine it's like a big truck.
Fighting against you, yeah?
Yeah.
By the end of 1915, the industrial bases of the warring nations were beginning to hit their stride and crippling shell shortages were addressed as ever more resources were redirected into the manufacture of munitions.
Yep, so you've got artillery of all types, shapes and sizes being produced in ever-increasing numbers. And the generals have a vista of unlimited shells raining down on the enemy trenches. That's not only that, there's also something else coming on stream, if you like.
The recruiting fervour of 1914 had generated a harvest of fresh new divisions of partially trained and frighteningly keen soldiers.
Well, yeah, the Kitchener's Army, wasn't it?
The early British attempts to break the line, I'll carry on.
You will.
The early British attempts to break the line had concentrated on using artillery to rupture the line and then to pour troops through the gap to victory.
Now, the shortage of guns and shells, coupled with the ability of the German High Command to move up their reserves to seal the gap, had resulted in lengthy casualty lists and only minor advantages measured in yards rather than miles. So it was decided to raise the stakes. They're going to amass ever more artillery and men at the selected point and wear down the German reserves by a process of attrition and concentrated attacks by the Allies as a whole, the French, Russians, Belgians, British, everybody, over the coming year. However, there's a problem. What could that problem be? Who else is in the war?
The thought processes of the German High Command under General Ernst von Falkenhayn were not dissimilar. And it was he who launched the first blow at Verdun on the 21st February 1916. The concept behind the Verdun offensive was blood-curdling in its murderous simplicity.
Yeah, Falkenhayn's aim is to create a mincing machine. And this is all a bit cliched, this next bit, but it does actually sum up the essence that would crush the life from the French army, drawing division after division into the maw of the German guns. Territorial gains there to be secondary to their killing. Ah, kill, kill, kill. There's a problem, though.
Yeah, so his original intention was it to be an artillery battle, but the Germans were not immune from the hot passions of war, and despite their best intentions, they were first drawn to extend the contested front by French artillery concentrations on their flanks before they themselves became obsessed with actually capturing Verdun.
Well, the result of that, and we've been to Verdun, the battlefield's amazing, isn't it, Gary? One of our favourite places to visit on the Western Front. But the German casualties, their casualties escalate until they're equal, if not higher, to those of the French. And the whole point of Falkenhayn's plan, the exercise they're undertaking, was lost.
Yeah, there's that horrible phrase, isn't there, to bleed the French white. But actually what's happening is they're both suffering.
That's right. So now, while the French are otherwise engaged at Verdun, the French had been intending to take the lead in the big offensive, but the baton's handed to Haig and British. Now, what army does he have?
Well, it's unrecognisable from the highly professional small force that had landed in France in August 1914. The battered regular divisions had been rebuilt, the territorial divisions had arrived, and the Kitchener New Army divisions were coming on stream in ever-increasing numbers.
Now, this, in its turn, generates more problems. There's just not enough regulars with recent experience of war to train all these millions of men. And in general, then, the officers, the NCOs and the men are all pretty well untrained in any real sense. They're enthusiastic amateurs in the tough business of war, and a lot of them are just all but blinded by their own delusions of what's going to happen, the glorious combat they face. They're hamstrung. What are they hamstrung by?
Their lack of personal skill in weapons handling, ignorant of all but the simplest battle tactics, above all, totally unfamiliar with the dreadful cocktail of confusion, fatigue and terror that made up the shock of war, which could strip a man naked in the face of his enemies. Not literally.
Not literally, obviously. Well, depends on how near the shell bursts. Now, Haig plans for the Somme. He plans to launch 25 of his divisions, supported by some 1,500 guns and howitzers, into the attack along a wide frontage of about 25,000 yards to the north of the River Somme. It was considered that the artillery would suppress resistance, although that it's more, they're not so much suppressing as destroying, and that the infantry would have little problem in opening up a wide gap in the German line.
Well, the final stage would see an advance to roll up the German line towards Arras. Lieutenant General Sir Henry Rawlinson, now in command of 4th Army, was given the responsibility for carrying out the initial attack, whilst the Reserve Army, commanded by Lieutenant General Sir Hubert Gough, would lead the exploitation to the north.
Now, so Haig and Rawlinson are laying their plans, and we're not going into that at all. But the war in the air was slowly beginning to develop a coherent pattern, wasn't it?
Trenchard always sought to dominate the airspace over the German lines, whatever the disadvantages his pilots may have been under. In April, he received a letter from the commander of the French Air Service in the Verdun area that confirmed many of his instinctive beliefs. And you're going to tell us what Commandant de Poitiers of the French Air Service says.
Aircraft can be divided into two, army machines and combat machines. And these aircraft can be employed in two separate ways, either by using the combat machines to protect the army machines or by letting the latter fend for themselves so that the combat machines can do the real job of fighting. We've employed both methods and here are the results. Like the Germans, we began by adopting the second method, and thanks to our offensive efforts, we attained a material and moral superiority so marked that the enemy were forced to protect their enemy machines. We were proud of this. It made us a little complacent. We yielded to the demands of our own army corps, which wanted close protection for their hard-pressed cooperation machines. We in turn were driven to adopt the first method and were barely able to hold our own with the enemy. The strongest formations of aircraft proved themselves masters of the situation. We then resumed the second method and immediately recaptured local air superiority by going after it. There were two main drawbacks. The first was this. The corps commanders, misunderstanding what was at stake, protested shrilly at being left in the lurch, despite the fact that the corps machines, by flying formations of three, as ordered, managed to do their work, protect themselves, and suffer relatively few casualties in the process.
The second drawback has been the acute nervous strain imposed on our combat pilots who are carrying the fight non-stop to the enemy's back areas, fighting and dropping their bombs far from their own bases and within constant range of the German anti-aircraft defences. Our losses in the air may be heavy, but they are much less than those we are inflicting on the enemy. And our air mastery is proving of enormous advantage to the troops on the ground. Now, to explain that, which people were probably laughing at the accent more than... I don't know what accent that was. It wasn't French.
Don't you ever say anything about Rick Toffin again.
Sure, I won't. To use a footballing or a rugby analogy, this is the idea of you play the game over the lines in the enemy's half. And the reason you do that is because behind the scouts, pushing ever forward and pushing the attack over, that leaves the bits that really matter over the lines free for your core aircraft. That's the idea of it. It's offensive, push forward. If you play the game of football in the opponent's half, then you're risking a breakaway goal, but you'll probably win. And in rugby, you almost certainly will win. It makes sense to me, but it does a man demand the sort of cold-bloodedness. Would you not say?
Yeah, it does, and particularly in the circumstances that the RFC found themselves in.
Yeah.
So what we've done, skillfully...
Brilliantly, I think.
We've set the scene for the Battle of the Somme.
But did it really only start on the 1st of July, Gary? Did it?
No.
Oh. So we'll be doing the air offensive next.
We will.
Cheers, Gary. Yeah, how we said that together.
Yeah. I'm still crying from your French accent.
Sorry.
Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or... visit www.blah-blah-blah-blah-blah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?